Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Years ago, a young Englishman with no qualifications and no particular plan ended up picking grapes in Bordeaux. It was during one of the worst scandals the region had ever seen, but it was also the start of one of the most inventive careers the British wine trade has ever produced. Simon Farr went on to deliver champagne at 2 a.m. to London nightclubs in the oil boom 70s, co-founded Bibendum in 1982, and later built Crew World Wine on the conviction that price transparency and digital platforms were going to transform fine wine, whether the trade wanted them to or not. Now he says the wine trade isn't dying, but it is changing shape, and that anybody who thinks they can wait out this crisis is making a very big mistake. And of course, he's not waiting for anything. He's launching something brand new. In this episode, we talk about why the restaurant trade is in structural trouble, why the bottom of the production period might not survive, and yet why Simon, despite all of this, is still putting his own money into new wine ventures. I'm Felicity Carter, and this is Drinks Insider. Simon, how did you get into wine in the first place? I've read that you were working in Bordeaux vineyards in 1973. How did you end up there, and what happened then?
Well, I ended up there. I ended up because I'd gone to France after school. I mean, I went to one of these sort of mixed progressive boarding schools where we basically didn't do anything. So I didn't end up with any
any qualifications. Lucky person.
I learned to be an adolescent, so that was kind of fun. But I left really without any paper or any paper qualifications or any idea.
Okay. I have to stop you right there. What was a progressive boarding school like 50 years ago? What made it progressive?
Well, I mean, I think basically because they were very much sort of saying, well, we don't want to be very prescriptive and we don't want to rules. And for example, I edited the school magazine in my final year, and that was deemed to be more important than studying for my exams.
And do you regret it now, Simon, or do you think that was excellent use of your time?
I think it certainly made us different, and it made me think different. I mean, I've never been very good at thinking in a very sort of linear way. So, so I've always sort of, my mind has always roped, and that's allowed me to stumble upon different ideas. Some of which might have been good, some might have been not so good, but hey.
So Bordeaux, so how did you go
I went to France, and then actually parents of somebody at school had retired to France.
In disgust at what had happened to their kids, or?
No, I think they just one of them was an Englishman working as a history professor in California, and the other one was, and his wife was a archaeologist who'd spent most of her career digging up Santorini. And they decided they wanted to sort of get back together, and they wanted to move to Europe because they didn't like America anymore. And so they bought a place in Bordeaux, and then they invited me to a party, which of course was the harvest. It wasn't a party at all. It was slave labor. I didn't really know one end of the bottle of wine from another. I had a sort of classic non-wine upbringing of the sort of 1950s, 60s England. But I took to this extremely well. I mean, this place was extremely basic. It's an unknown chateau, and its reputation didn't rise to, by virtue of me working there. But I went to this party, did the harvest. I turned up at the time of the last really big scandal in Bordeaux in 72, the Cruz Bert scandal.
And so I don't know about that scandal.
The naughty boys and the négociants got found sort of mixing Algerian wine with the there was a lot of creative production going on, and they got sort of found out, and it basically sort of bankrupted the region. Really, it was the last time it really was incredibly dire, and the Ponte Canet was lost, and eventually the Ginestés lost Chateau Margaux. You know, it really was a terrible time. So all the calculations that this couple had made about how they could make their little nondescript chateau into something that was a subsistence went out the window. So he went back to teaching history. And I stayed. I stayed on and basically worked there for 3 years. You know, trying to make ends meet. There was a fantastic intro. It turned out to be an incredible sort of university, really. You know, at the sort of the foundation base of our industry.
Oh, that's what an amazing story. And why did you leave? Did you finally get tired of the hard labor?
Well, I mean, 7 days a week, you know, 20. I mean, it's pretty worky, eaty, sleepy when you're working. And you know, so there wasn't much career projection. So there was nothing really, you know, after a while, and it wasn't going anywhere. And I was curious, you know, of what else I could do. So I came back to London and thought I'd get to the other end.
So between that and the really big thing which happened is Bibendum in 1982, what were you doing between those years?
Well, I came back and I was sort of pretty unemployable. So I ended up, I chanced upon a couple of people who were creating a small group of wine shops. And they basically took me on to essentially run it because they were sort of busy doing, well, not very much, basically. One of them was a sort of an classicist who seemed to like chasing girls and drinking more than anything else. So I ended up sort of being thrust this business, which wasn't really a business, and sort of growing it into a group of shops. That was fascinating because it got me from understanding the basics of production to understanding the basics of, you know, how people buy things and why. And an understanding of the sort of basics of the wine trade.
Still, you must have been pretty young when you founded Bibendum.
I was young.
Where did you get the money from? Did you just save all? Or?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, from that I started a business in, it was the first 24/7 and it's sort of selling champagne to the clubs in the late 70s. And then I sold that. And actually, so I learned to do a business of my own. I did everything myself. I did the deliveries, I did the buying, the selling, the accounting, the whole thing. So it was a real kind of, you know, I had a sort of practical education, basically, you know, planting and growing the stuff, making it, then, you know, learning how to sell it and then how to turn it into a business.
What was it like selling champagne to nightclubs in the late 70s, which was...
Well, it was fantastic because
which was a depressed era, wasn't it?
It was, except that the Middle East was full of former nomadic Arabs who discovered that oil was the secret to their futures. And so they'd had all this incredible amount of money and they weren't allowed to drink at home. So they came to London and spent all their gains on, you know, having the high life. And so the London clubs were actually booming. And so they were, and all they wanted to drink was Rodo Cristal and Dom Perignon and Krug. And I happily provided it for them. And the supermarket, the champagne houses didn't want to do that distribution because they couldn't get anybody to deliver after 8 in the evening. And these places didn't open until then. So I found myself a little niche. And I sort of did that for a couple of years. Yeah, well, actually, I just sort of trained. I said I would deliver any time of the day or night because you haven't got any storage. And that was a great sales pitch. And in fact, I sort of disciplined them to, you know, I would ring up at 8 and say, well, how's things going? What's the night looking? You know, have you got any stock? And I'd sort of get the deliveries in early. So I rarely had to sort of do a emergency delivery in the early hours.
God, that's hilarious. So you were doing that and then did you need some sleep? Why did you sell it?
Well, it was an interesting thing to do, but it was great fun because there I was in my 20s and I was driving around London with a white panel van full of, you know, luxury champagne. So I had a fantastic social life, as you can imagine. I was invited to lots of parties, but by that time it was just a rinse and repeat thing. And after a while, I thought, and also I had an opportunity to sell it. So I sold it, and selling a business was a great thing. I mean, it's a fantastic thing if you want, you know, it's a very rare thing to be able to do. So I sold the business. I did reasonably well. I went off for a year and I worked in Napa. And then I started a sort of fine wine broking business. I wanted to take advantage of the new low-cost airlines that were flying around the world. And I thought, well, my parents lived in Hong Kong at the time, So I thought, well, I could go to Los Angeles and then Hong Kong and then London, and I could kind of sell fine wine, you know, around the world. And I thought, this is a terribly glamorous sort of thing to do. My problem was I couldn't find anybody to give me enough stock for long enough, because in those days, you know, there was no internet or anything. So everything was done by sort of telex machine mail and so on. So to get people to hold stock for a long enough time was very difficult. And I chanced upon a chap who was recommended to me, who turned out to be an extraordinary character who started a company called Majestic.
Oh, right. And okay, so Majestic is a chain of wine. Well, you buy by the case. Buy wine by the case, I think. Yeah.
It was the first real chain of wine warehouses, sort of selling by the case, and it was very much a sort of a creature of the sort of the 80s, 90s. And I went to see him to sort of say, can you? Because I heard you had lots of stock. Can I have a hold on it so I can go off and do this thing? And then we got talking and we got on really well. He was quite a character.
Who is this?
And he was a chap called Sheldon Grainer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. that's a Dickensian name.
Yeah, and Sheldon had bought a warehouse in Wood Green. And on his way from his flat to the warehouse, he used to pass this hotel in Finsbury Park called the Majestic. So he thought, oh, I could name my company Majestic. So that's how Majestic got named. But I turned up and there was a guy called Tony who used to be at Augustus Barnett, which is a big group of wine shops. And there was a FD and then he said, well, why don't you come and join me? He said, rather than doing that, he said, you know, you could help me here. And so I ended up being the sort of fourth person. And I got put in charge of strategy. So I kind of designed the... No, for Majestic.
Oh, for Majestic, sorry, right.
Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, Majestic was... The original iteration of Majestic was very short-lived, because it turned out that Sheldon, being the kind of large-in-life character he was, had basically all the collateral for our loans to the bank were all basically fraudulent. So he'd buy huge parcels of the fine wine for a sort of, you know, £100 a case, and then he'd flip them for £99 a case. But he'd keep the bond receipts, because the good old days of paper. And he'd take the bond receipts to the bank and say, listen, here's another 100 grand. Can you lend me 100? Which they would do. But finally, we, you know, and as directors, having found this out, we had to shop him to the bank. And so the thing went it was put into liquidation.
And what happened to him?
Well, he started out as a minicab driver, you know, what nowadays would be an Uber driver from sort of Tottenham. And he ended up, I think he ended up in jail, actually.
Yeah. Goodness,
but anyway, gracious. So it was originally, the people who, Majestic sort of really, for most people, started after that. And it was put into a closed sort of bid by the bank. And it was won by... Credit Suisse First Boston, Charles Clark and Esme Johnson, who most people know, because they then took it and expanded it massively before it sort of went again. But actually, interesting enough, the person who came second in that was a guy called Chris Collins. And I had shown him round and thought he was a really interesting person. And he was interested in, he'd been in a family big business and sold that and wanted to be in wine. So, and anyway, I rang him up on the day when it was sold, and I said, I'm sorry you came second, Chris, in this. But he said, but I've got a better idea. And he laughed. And I said, and then he said, well, come and see me. So I went to see him, and I pitched this sort of elevator pitch for the Bibendum thing. Because my view was that the problem with Majestic was it was trying to do too much, too low in the market. And I thought supermarkets would make it very difficult for that to be profitable. But I thought what really needed changing was the fine wine market, which was very stuffy, very St. James's, very inaccessible. And we were just moving into the beginning of the sort of the boom period for the boomers. And that was a huge growing middle class of people who didn't go to Eton, you know, most of them. And they didn't, you know, they didn't shop in St. James's. And they were very curious and wanted to sort of to learn, and they wanted access. And so the wine warehouse idea was was very conducive to that. But I thought, so if we put, rather than putting, bottles of Liebfraumilch in a warehouse, why don't we put imperials of Petrus? which is how we started.
Why not? So can you briefly, can you give a two-sentence introduction to what Bibendum is and where it went?
Well, the idea was really that that time we had this kind of artificial three-tier system in the UK, which wasn't like in the US where it's prescripted. It's a legal thing. And, you were an importer or a wholesaler or a retailer. And I thought, well, this is nonsense. You've basically got one producer and you've got a consumer and there are different routes there that get to each other. And it's much more efficient to have fewer intermediaries, buyers directly as possible and sellers directly as possible. Now, today, that wouldn't sound terribly revolutionary, but I can tell you at the end of the 70s, early 80s, that was pretty radical. So that was really the idea behind Bibendum, was really to sort of look at the top end of the market and sort of democratize it, in this overused word, but make it much more accessible. And also to make it as good value as possible by going as close, as directly as one could to the producer. And then straight to the consumer. And also to go through every channel to market. So rather than just being a retailer, we would start by selling to private clients, but then we would grow into selling to restaurants. And so what happened was we started at, the insight was really, I think, was reflective of a changing time, what was not available now that was available then was a massive secular change in the world, which is really driven by demographics. I mean, we turned up in 82 at the beginning of the sort of modern era of fine wine. It was the 82 Bordeaux vintage. It was Robert Parker. It was the baby boomers suddenly getting into their stride. They were now getting jobs and and then we had a following wind of globalization technology. I mean, basically it made us look like geniuses, but the reality was that there was this great following wind. And so Bibendum just happened to turn up at the right time. And we did have, we articulated a slightly more open, accessible, more rational way of presenting the category.
Yeah, okay. So you've seen the rise. And of course, Margaret Thatcher revolutionised the UK economy as well. You saw the rise of the baby boomers, and now they're all exiting the market. Do you think that the good times are over forever because of demographics, or do you think this was all driven by demographics and social changes, or do you think wine made mistakes along the way that has led it to where it is now?
I think demographics is a huge part of. I mean, externalities. I take a lot more. I pay a lot more attention to externalities increasingly, the sort of older I get. Yeah. And I think that, broadly, I think demographics is a massive structural backdrop to any era. The only thing that seems to be certain in the world is that nature works in cycles. And I think, and if one looks at history, one does see that happening. I think that, when we came in with the Bibendum in the early 80s, we were at the beginning of a new cycle. And I think we are struggling our way through the last part of that cycle. And I think we're at this inflection point where we are going off into a new cycle. And I think that the good times as we've known them are over, but that's because it's not going to be the same. There are different generations with different preferences, different priorities. They found a way to want to consume wine for the last 6,000 years or so. And I can't believe that they're going to stop. I just think they're going to look at it differently. I think
Yes. In the late 90s, I read a book which had a big impact on me. It was called The Empty Raincoat by economist Charles Handy. And he basically said the received wisdom was that industries or big companies had a 40-year cycle. Yeah. And that everything exists on a bell curve. And what happens with most companies or industries is they get to the top of the bell curve and they think, well, this is great. I'm going to keep doing whatever took me here. And actually that's the moment that you have to change, because it's a mathematical certainty that you're about to go down the other side. And I think if you start the modern wine world at 1982, you can really see that 40-year cycle almost perfectly.
Yes, exactly. I think it is exactly right. I think it's a sort of, whether it's a Kondratiev wave or there's lots of ways of, you know, the fourth turning. And there are lots of people who talk about cycles and they're all slightly different. But I think the fundamental underlying dynamics are absolutely right. And I think that the problem with a good time is that, you know, emotion, you want it to continue.
Absolutely.
And you're resistant to, you know, something that you knew and understood and worked, you know, suddenly becoming difficult to understand and not working. And, you know, and I think actually, but in a way, I think what one needs to do and what we all need to do is we need to lean into it and you know, apply a lot of curiosity.
Well, actually, that brings us to Crew Worldwide, which is an interesting one. So 2013, you founded that. Can you talk about what that was and what led you to found it, what it does?
Well, essentially, Bendon was sort of growing like Topsy. And we it was much easier to grow the trade business. So restaurants, hotels, airlines, supermarkets, what have you. And we had a fine wine business, which was sort of was our starting point. And it was private client business, but it became a slightly sort of orphan division. It was doing quite well, but it was, and we needed new computer systems and so on. And then in the end, we thought we'd got to make some choices here. So we got too many tigers by the tail, and we need, you know, and it's difficult to manage one, let alone, you know, several. So we made a decision at the board that we ought to probably close the division. And I said, I'll buy it, you know, and I'll take it out. You know, I mean, I didn't leave Bibendum, but I was a non-executive, you know, from about 2000 anyway. But, so I took it out and I turned it into Crew. And my thought was that the world is changing and that, we're seeing the sort of the march of digital. You know, and that is basically heralding an era of transparency. And I saw what happened in the Big Bang with stockbrokers, which I liken the old style stockbrokers. I liken to the sort of the fine wine merchants. You know, and I think they you know, through during that Big Bang period, and most of them went away, and what you ended up was the world of indexes and platforms. And so you had a lot more empowerment of the consumer. You had much lower fees, much greater choice, you know, an opportunity to really customize what you did. That world had to respond because there was so much regulatory push. Whereas, you know, nobody really cared about the fine wine business. So we could carry it on as if we were still in the 80s with sort of oak panel rooms and playing golf and having lunch. And I thought, well, you know, that's going to change. And if we don't change it, somebody's going to come along and do it. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity to kind of try and be part of inventing the thing that's going to finally kill us.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so I'd rather... You know, I'd rather have
a go. Creative destruction before somebody else does.
Yeah, so I thought, well, you know, Mr. Schumpeter is going to turn up and destroy us, and we better do something about it. So I thought, well, let's build a platform. And so we started Crew, and basically, I mean, and you know, I don't mind. I mean, we sort of had a fine wine. We were building a marketplace that was masquerading as a fine wine business. Essentially, we're using the fine wine business as a beta tester. So what we did, rather than coming up with some massive 5-year plan or 10-year plan about how we're going to change the world, we thought, well, let's really start digging in how we can structure something that's going to make a much more, you know, be much more efficient and much more sort of consumer friendly and much more sort of objectively based. And so we did that by iterating endlessly. So we started to build the platform. We did it basically on the feedback we were actually getting, what people actually do rather than what we thought they should do or did do. And so as a result, we built something. And really, it wasn't me. I mean, it was Jeremy Howard runs the business. You know, Jeremy is an extraordinary character. And he's a PhD from Oxford. He'd worked for Goldman Sachs. And he designed the option trading platform for Deutsche in New York. You know, and
what do you think you learned about the behavior of fine wine buyers that the wine trade had missed maybe for centuries? What do fine wine buyers want to do that hadn't been captured before?
Well, I think that it's, I think that an awful lot is, that a lot of our job was done for us in terms of giving people the ability to sort of make buying decisions. This supercomputer in our pocket has got ever more super and ever more computery, and ever, now it's with AI and so on. Everybody has got every bit of information there ever was. And it's being able to curate that information increasingly in a way that it can, it isn't a chore to try and work out what one should buy. I think what we needed to go along with that, and what we do still, is we need to get to grips with a world where if you charge for something, if you don't add value commensurate to that charge, my view is eventually you won't be able to charge that. So I think you need to, and I think just sort of breaking having lots of fine wine merchants sort of doing an offer of the latest release of Comte de Champagne or something at a sort of everybody having the same margin, everybody having the same price, but really sort of taking no risk and just sort of stick it on a mail, I think is something which is unlikely to prove to be, I think there's an awful lot of friction in that for the consumer. And I think, I think one of the problems we have is we have a very low velocity in this trade, and, we don't trade enough. And that's, so therefore price discovery is very, very bad. There aren't enough data points. If you go out at night and you have a bottle of something and you think, oh, that's fantastic. And then you make the mistake of buying 10 cases on the way home on your phone. And you wake up in the morning with buyer's remorse thinking, oh God, what have I done? You've got to wait for sort of 15% to burn off before you can flip it again. So, it really is an inhibitor to buying and selling. So what you need to do is to, as you have with financial services, you need to get down to the point where the frictional cost of trading is really not a barrier to trading. We need to get that out of the way.
Okay, so if I join Crew,
yeah,
what is the service that you'll offer me? What can I do on the platform?
Well, firstly, we've got, I think hundreds of millions of pounds worth of offers on there. So people, and a lot of the trade, people from other countries will load wine into the platform, and they say you have most of what is in the market is available on the platform. You can buy that there and with instant execution. That will then go to your account, or you will elect to have it cleared from bond or whatever and delivered. If you want to sell, you can go into the platform, you can load your wine. And if you're an importer, you're a producer or whatever, or a négociant in Bordeaux or something, you can load that wine in there. You can determine what price it is. It's anonymous.
Sell it as an individual, or do I need to go
absolutely.
To somebody?
I mean, our view is that there is, I think my personal belief is that I don't think there are many reasons why one should distinguish between trade and retail. I think they're all customers in the end. And I think the price is the price. And we're seeing that increasingly in markets.
One of the things the fine wine trade has historically loathed is transparency of price. Did you get any pushback from people when you opened?
Well, I think that we're not a sort of, we're not actually. I mean, as much as I'd love to be the great innovator, the fact is we're not really the driver of this. To me, the digitalization and the immediate availability of pricing, offers around the world are immediately available, whether it's, rather badly in Wine Searcher or, if you're a trader in Libex, or just literally Googling it, you can sort of find the price of anything. So essentially, the market would sort out price. And I think that one of the things the trade is struggling to come to terms with is that if you, in the old days, you would sort of buy something for this and you'd add your margin, which is a sort of a term, and that would become the price. In a world of bid and offer, which is something we didn't invent it, all we did is follow the playbook that's been elsewhere. Essentially, that may be the price, but it may not. It may be that the bids come in lower than that. You never know, they might come up higher. But the fact is, what we don't have anymore is we were never going to have, whether we liked it or not, we were never going to actually have control over price.
Can you see how much wine is traded in accordance with specific events? Like, did you suddenly see a big spike in trading around the coronation, or, you know, does it all drop off around elections? What's the best and the worst times for trading?
Well, I think it's, well, actually, I think it, because our platform is sort of, is a mixture of, you know, very large stockholders, you know, small mum and pop buyers and sellers. There is kind of no pattern. I mean, generally, the bigger trades are done with trade people, and the smaller ones, not all actually. I mean, we've got some. I mean, there's an awful lot of private clients, particularly in the last 40 years, who have are actually were bigger traders than the traders.
Oh, really interesting.
Yeah, so, they would build huge portfolios of wine. And
so you're not seeing any of the people who live in Dubai dumping their stocks right now, anything like that?
Well, there has been a bit of that. In fact, you remember we were talking with Evgeny from Hedonism, that fantastic shop in London.
Yeah.
And he was saying an awful lot of, you know, the big fat cat money has left the UK.
Gone to Dubai. Him, lucky
yeah,
them.
Yeah, changed. Well, yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think that, you know, these things, these flows happen all the time, you know, and it's... in London, it was, you know, one year it was the Russians, then it was the Chinese, and then it was the, you know, there's always different, there's different people with money around. And it isn't just London. That's the other thing. It's a very international business now. And I think we need to understand that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is, if you've got a service like this, is you can get a very good sense of what stock is sitting where in the world.
Correct.
So you can see what's sitting in client reserves. What does all of that tell you about the market right now?
Well, I think that what it tells me is, I think that one of the great things that the baby boomers bought the business was they had an incredible enthusiasm, a propensity to buy, every year on primeur. I think a lot of those people, though, have been surprised at how much wine they built up in their bonded reserves. And of course, they're discovering this just at the point when their doctor's saying, well, you maybe ought to be cutting back a bit. You're sort of getting on a bit, Charlie, you know. Sort of. So we now have, you know, and I think a lot of the stock that was, a lot of the wine that was bought on primeur through that 45-year sort of boom period from the early 80s to sort of say COVID or so, you know, that is, a lot of it is undrunk, which is a problem. And
it's interesting that you're talking about this, because for years I've been asking auction houses this about, because you can actually see this happening in antiques and porcelain, that as people downsize, they've flooded the market. And actually, it actually led to the collapse of prices in some sections of the antique market.
Sure.
I was like, when is this going to happen to wine? And they went, no, it's not happening, it's not happening. Obviously, it is happening.
Yeah.
What is this going to do to the price of wine? Does this mean that suddenly there'll be lots of 1982 Petrus around at a good price?
Well, I think it's interesting because... If you just think about the price you bought at, if you bought a lot of wine in the 80s on primeur, you know, wine was actually, well, you know, was good value. And so you may say, well, that, you know, that case of Pichon Lanond only cost me 80 quid. I know I've held it and put it in bond and had to pay storage, but in a way your appetite for taking a discount off the current, in inverted commas, market price is much greater because you've got, you know, because you bought cheaply. So I think one of the issues is that there's, I don't know, I haven't done the numbers and I don't know if I could, but, you know, there was an awful lot on that way up, there was an awful lot of wine bought, at very affordable prices relative to today's market. So I think the market has potentially got a long way to drop. And then, you know, you have what you have is a lot, you have a big pig and a snake, and you've got a very small exit. And of course, you've also got a small exit at a time when producers are trying to push more vintages onto the market, naturally.
Yes, and this is, as we've previously discussed, one of the biggest problems in the fine wine market at the moment is a fall in trust, particularly among people who who bought on-premer. So the promise of on-premer was always that you would buy wine in barrel at the best price it was going to be, and then when it was released a couple of years later, the price was going to go up. Now, that hasn't happened. The chateaus increasingly priced the final price into the on-premer prices.
Exactly.
So now people are getting offers for the wines they bought on-premer at huge discounts, and there's been a dramatic loss of trust in the market. So is is that just a matter of waiting out the overhang of stock, or is there something fundamentally that has to change in the way that fine wine is traded, particularly through Bordeaux?
Well, I think that the my personal view is that if we go back to the origins of on-premer, essentially it was a device whereby producers could lay off their production, in the spring after the vintage. They basically picked it, crushed it, fermented it, stuck it into a barrel, and they moved it into the trade. And the trade then took it on the long journey through maturity, marketed it, and then it went to the consumer. And the transfer price, effectively the on-premer price that the producer charged, was really really based on fundamentals. It was essentially the cost of production plus an incentive margin, maybe a little premium for prestige. But essentially, they left enough of the downstream theoretical downstream value to incentivize, everybody else to then take it for the rest of its journey to the point where the cork was pulled. And so I think that, and that made a lot of sense. And then, and of course, in the 80s, we discovered that actually we could, as the trade, we didn't have to be the stockholders. We could actually lay that off again to the consumer. But we also offered them the proposition that, if you buy 20, you can probably sell 100. And if you buy 3 cases, you could probably sell 2 and drink the third for free. And that was kind of interesting. And that's sort of how on-premer grew. The problem was that we went through this great moderation, this long period of time where we had the baby boomers flourishing, the globalization was happening, the interest rates were low, and it allowed everything to get bid up like crazy. And so they saw their wines, leaving at 20 and suddenly getting to 200, and they thought, bloody hell, we should have more of that. So progressively they increased their prices at the cellar door. And there was also an element of, not wanting to be cheaper than your neighbour and all the rest of it. And the problem was, you ended up in a situation where ultimately you'd basically added you'd created a price which was assuming a future that never arrived. So actually, when it got to the point where it was mature, the wines were actually selling at a discount to that. And you didn't leave anything on the table for the trade and the consumer to compensate them for risk and for cost. And so as a result, and of course that then manifests itself in seeing, well, you can buy a 20-year-old, first growth cheaper than you can buy the new one. And one, you've got something you can drink, and second, you've got almost no risk relative to this wine, which is still uncertain to us how it's going to taste when it's mature.
So now we've got a situation where we've got some chateaus that have pulled out of on-premer, where some chateaus are not releasing all of their stock, they're holding some back, and where the négociants are not necessarily any longer representing the middle tier of Bordeaux, the cru bourgeois.
Yeah.
But Bordeaux still needs on-premer because it likes having a week or so where the world is watching it. Do you see a way out of this situation? Do you think the market will eventually correct it? Or what has to happen for this system to work again?
Well, I think, I'm always fond of quoting Herbert Stein, he says that what can't go on forever will stop. So, my view is that, the decision that the producers have got to make, which Latour made it early, is that if you want to control your positioning, then you have to be the stockholder. If you want to share essentially what is the production process, in other words, the aging bit and you need to price it so that there's an incentive for that to happen. And the producers have got to decide if they want, either they incentivize the trade and the consumers to buy their wine early, or they're going to have to finance the thing themselves. And an awful lot of them, there's a logistics issue where there's, you know, space, and there's also a cost, you know. And so eventually they will either, you know, a lot of them haven't got the wherewithal to do that. Some have. But essentially it will, you know, and I think the easiest and least capital intensive solution is to find a way to go back to pricing on fundamentals so that you make it worthwhile to buy early.
Well, speaking of pricing, one of the most surprising things about this wine recession is that we're not seeing a spike at the lower end. Like normally in recessionary environments or cost squeezes, you'd see people trade down, but they're not trading down. No. And in fact, it's the commodity end that's in enormous trouble with vineyards being ripped out. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there are lots of sort of secular trends. I think one of them is that I think that we've gone from a period where every wine was sort of bog off, you know, buy one, get one free. And it was all at sort of $2.99 at the, you know, stacked up in front of Tesco's. And I think where people were sort of necking a bottle of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc before they started cooking, you know, every day. And I think we were in a real booze culture. And I think that was not healthy. And I think that, for all the sort of misleading stuff about health, which you've been actually at the forefront of exposing, the reality is I think people do feel that we ought to be drinking, we ought to be doing less of these sorts of things. It's better for us. I think the other thing is that actually the economics of the production don't work. The problem is that it costs an awful lot to make cheap wine, as it does to make expensive wine. And increasingly, the cost pressures with, you know, climate volatility, you know, all the sort of inputs they're having to put in, all the rest of it, and making the base of wine production, you know, not terribly viable. And I think if you take the largest wine-growing region in the world, which is Europe, and you took away the subsidies, I think it's not clear to me how many of those vineyards will still be in business in a few years.
Well, here in Germany, the official figure is that 30% of wineries are not profitable. Unofficially, the figure is more like 50%.
Yes.
So there's a view among many people in wine that actually we wouldn't miss those wines if they went. Maybe they should go. Sitting in Europe, the devastation to rural regions would be extraordinary. What's your view about this?
Well, I think that I sort of think it's inevitable, and I think therefore it needs to be managed, you know. And I think it can be managed. I mean, if you look at what the New Zealand, lamb farmers did when the UK joined the European Union. I mean, it kind of, you know, they were left high and dry by their government, and they kind of almost, it pretty much bankrupted the farmers in New Zealand.
I didn't know that.
They had to adapt, and they adapted very quickly. They had to. It was survival.
Bet the lambs were happy. What was the adaptation they did?
Well, they just had to find ways to make new markets, you know, probably change. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to look it up.
So,
but I think it's an example of the fact that and I think that what will happen in Europe is that, look, I think that when we started Majestic, and you went down a supermarket aisle, there was a huge amount of wine that would entice a new generation of wine drinkers to get on board. Okay, it was affordable, it was exciting, it was interesting. You could have, and they had from the top to the bottom of choice, and it was all very exciting. You go down a supermarket aisle today, and I'm sorry, but I don't think very much what you see is actually terribly much to do with wine. I think it's very industrial. I think it's characterless. It's not about a person and a place and, you know, and an interesting idea. I don't think it talks to the sort of values of of particularly newer generations. And I think, given the choice that people have of what to consume with alcohol, there is, you know, the choice is enormous. And yeah, I don't think wine is a particularly good competitor. So I think an awful lot of wine just doesn't, and I don't think we ought to be drinking it in sort of, we probably don't want to be drinking it in huge volumes. So I think that if you look at the pyramid of production, you've got 90-something percent of it, which is increasingly not sustainable, I think, on many different
I just want to come to this thing about the homogenization of the supermarket shelf. So you see this in the United States very clearly, where now at retail you're getting wines from big brands which have locked up the shelves, and they're all the same because they all, they all taste test and benchmark against each other. So there's actually incredibly homogenous. But what happened with the interesting wines was they got premiumized away, that if it was interesting around the $12, that it went to $15 But what happened in the UK to make it homogenous and boring? Because you do have some of the best supermarket buyers in the world. So you've got lots of MWs. Sure. You've got Europe on the doorstep. So why is it so bad? Is it just the taxes?
Okay, the reality is you've got 20% of VAT, and if you're in the inexpensive end, the fixed amount of duty is a much larger component of that bottle. So the problem you have as a supermarket buyer is you're not actually selling terribly much wine to your customers. You're selling an awful lot of everything else, a lot of which is tax. And I think that progressively what we're seeing, as part of this kind of financial repression, which is sort of happening, is we're seeing everything sort of so taxed and so regulated. The costs, surrounding anything are exerting so much gravity, and it's becoming, and what suffers is the product. The product that people are actually coming to buy is progressively less and less of what it is they're actually paying for. And that makes it makes when they get home and they open it, they're going, well, this isn't very interesting. And, £10 for that?
Essentially, when you were talking about being in your 20s and driving around to nightclubs delivering champagne, my thought was you couldn't do that anymore. That would be an impossible business for somebody who was 23 or 24 to open up. Couldn't be done.
Well, we used to open. I can tell you, we had had, I remember going around London and, the traditional mind. I mean, the amount of first growth Bordeaux I was given, and old wines. We drank incredible things, and there were, wine was. What was interesting is, when we started Bibendum, and on a Saturday morning, the place would be full. Yes, we'd have people with money and so on, but we had a lot of sort of middle class professional people. Who would buy Bordeaux, Burgundy, Rhone, etc., on Prima, and pretty good names. Nowadays, that's unaffordable.
Well, actually, but one thing that is affordable that wasn't true then is that the wine world has expanded enormously. Now, you said the other day that there's a new generation of consumers who'll buy a wine label that's written in a script they can't read from a country they've never visited. So how has that changed the market?
Well, I think you can see it if you look at the new generation of wine shops and hybrids, as I call them. And I mean, I think then one of the ways we're going to solve the restaurant problem, I think, is the opportunity to sort of flip the thing on its head and make it a wine thing with a bit of food attached. And we're seeing hybrids, which by some observers said it's up to 50% of the retail sort of independent wine scene. Is we're seeing hybrids where people can go in and they can take a bottle off the shelf at retail price and pay the equivalent of corkage, and they can have a bit of charcuterie and cheese or whatever. And that's and I think it's giving an opportunity for people to come in and try and enjoy an experience. And I think that, we are talking increasingly to generations where experience and opportunities to meet and to socialize are incredibly important. And wine has a great place. It's a really convenient product to sort of be a catalyst for that. And I see the trade changing enormously. I think a lot of my generation are a bit slow to the party. They'd still like to sell, hundreds of cases of Lynch Bergeron Primeur, which would be nice too. But I think we do need to be curious about what's happening. And we are seeing that the market adapts. New generations work this stuff out, in their own image, and if we don't provide solutions, they'll do it for us.
And you're just about to invest hugely in something hybrid with wines from Piedmont. Tell me about that and why.
Well, I thought the one thing is, when I came back to London in the mid-70s, the trade, I thought that the value that the trade added more than anything was actually this propensity to hold stock. And I think one of the problems I find when you go to a restaurant or even to a wine shop today is you see all these wonderful producers whose wines you'd like to try, but almost all the examples you're
offered a sort of a bottle last Tuesday. You know, the lack of mature wines with good in trade quantities with good provenance, you know, is a problem, but it's also an opportunity. And I also, you know, I've spent 50 years, I mean, I've been over 50 years in the trade now, you know, trying to do things at the double. And I thought, well, I fancy a bit of this sort of slow wine. So I also thought, I think one of the variables that is sort of least appreciated is time. I think the value of time is actually an opportunity. It is a cost, however, as well. So there is a sting in that tail. But I thought, well, actually, if one found a way to reintroduce stockholding as a sort of central part of what one offered as a wine trader, I thought that was very interesting. And I thought,
are you holding the stock, or for what purpose are you holding it?
So what I do is I buy a lot of stock. I buy from producers. And the reason I chose Piemonte is for two reasons. One, because I like it. And secondly, because if it takes longer than I thought, which is almost certain for this thing to work, I'm buying something that generally doesn't go off. So you know, if I had to hold the wine for a few more years, you know, probably it would get better. In fact, almost certainly would get better, and therefore, you know, more interesting. So I chose Piemonte for that, and I thought that, and so I would buy directly from the producers, and they hold the wine for longer than say Burgundy or Bordeaux. So I would, by holding the wine then, and I actually hold the wine in Belgium, which is much less expensive to store. And I would be able to release the wines at roughly 10 years of age. Some would be less and some would be more. And so the idea would be to offer them to the market, you know, in trade quantities, at a time when, you know, they were at the beginning or sort of well into their maturity.
Now, are you going to come up against the problem that so few people know what aged wine tastes like anymore and don't understand the value of aged wine?
Well, I think if we don't hurry up, we will. So I think that, you know, and I think there is still, you know, I think if we didn't do this for another 20 years, then I think that there wouldn't be many people around who had the, you know, had much experience of aged wine. So I think this is a time to sort of, I think this is a niche. I've made my life even more complicated because, you know, as I got more and more involved in this, I got more and more interested in Alto Piemonte, in the Northern Piemonte, which used to be much more prestigious than the Barolo and the Barbaresco, but it sort of faded away. It's a long story, but essentially I've now got involved in an area which is even less known. And one of the reasons I got a place where, you know, I've said for a long time that I think the digital facilitates the analog in wine. I mean, wine is all about the analog. It's all about people and bottles and real physical things. And I think that I wanted to get a place where we could show people what we had and they can.
And this is Fitzrovia, yeah.
Yeah, and so I said, try this, and you know they can make their own minds up.
So hang on, you've got a storage of Piedmont wines in Belgium, and where does what exactly is the Fitzrovia space? Is this one of these?
So the long term storage. So the wines will go from the producers to Belgium, where it'll sit quietly, and then we'll bring it over. You know, we do sell around the world actually. So. And I actually think a lot of other markets will probably be, you know, greater. They are bigger markets for Piemonte than the UK, which is still very Bordeaux Burgundy. But there is a good market here. And so we will then bring wines into London City Bond, which is where we keep it. And then I wanted to have, and I've now got a space. I've got basically a place with two spaces. I've got one space on the left, which is really going to be a sort of tasting and events room. And it's a sort of, you know, we can sit sort of 20 odd people and, or have a bigger stand-up tasting. I don't want to have big things. I want to do it in much more like a sort of cellar door kind of idea. And there is a kitchen and, you know, loos and so on. And then on the other side, we're going to have our offices and so on. And then downstairs, we've got a big basement, which I'm sort of insulating and turn into a sort of, you know, a cellar where we can put a lot of stock. So we can do lots of tastings all the time. We can, you know, people can come and collect from there and what have you. I mean, it's primarily going to be in the early stages, more to do probably with the trade, where we'll invite people to come around and try things. And also we're going to have a space which we can say to other wine merchants and so on, if you want to have a producer in and have people come to taste and, you know, use the space.
You're going to end up with a space like Verbendum was at Provine. So there was a point where the Verbendum stand attracted everybody at 5 p.m. Yeah. None of us went there to do business. We went there because it was a great social space.
Yeah.
I was really sorry when Verbendum stopped appearing because it was the heart of a lot of Provine social.
Yeah.
Maybe no business will happen in your basement. Maybe it'll just be people coming around so they can have a nice.
Well, fun
time.
Enough, I think a lot of the opportunity in the sort of things that we've been investing in, they really do have a place, and I think they are an answer, and they, you know, and the quality value proposition is strong enough. But I think that this, the only way you really can do that in wine, and we have to go back to basics. You know, the best way to do that is to, you know, pour them a glass and, you know, let them make their own mind up. So that's why we need. And I think also I just want to get closer to, I want to spend more time in the practice of it rather than, I think there's too, you know, the digital, as I said, is there to facilitate the analog. There's, you know, we can get obsessed by sort of getting so digital that we don't have to talk to people, you know.
Final thought, Simon. If you're looking back over quite an extraordinary 50 years, you were to look ahead just for the next 10 years, how do you think the wine trade's going to shake itself out? And perhaps not just in the UK, but globally.
Well, I think the wine category is going to be smaller, and I imagine that the lack of affordability of the basin pyramid is probably driven as much by taxation and other regulatory costs as it is by the challenges in production. I think that will have to transform itself into, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, they'll come up with a new version of vermouth. You know, vermouth is, you know, is being reinvented, you know, but you're going to have to do something to make it an attractive and affordable thing. And I think it'll have, and I suspect it'll have less to do with, you know, wine as we understand it, which is just, you know, grapes squished, fermented and stuck in a bottle. And because I just don't think it will work. And I think that wine itself, therefore, as we understand it, will become a smaller and relatively higher priced. I think the very top will come down because I think that was a sort of transient thing. And I think the bottom will come up, and I think we'll end up, you know, with a smaller category, which is more about, you know, the age old characteristics, which is, you know, people in a place doing, you know, doing things with a sort of passion and vision, if you like, and that really excites people.
Simon, thank you very much.
Not at all. Yeah.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Do you feel good? Do 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 do.